I'm going to start with the context of these things I'm going to define, and let's see. Context, and a little bit breaking to what has been happening in the talks here. I want to not just talk about the quantum gravity. I'm interested in quantum gravity, but I have the among the primary goals is to talk about a large class of field theories. Okay, and I'm going to be doing that in something that I want to be covariant and local, and a more precise way of saying that is that I want it to be in the general boundary formulation or general boundary field theory way of thinking, and that's what you're going to see in what follows. And then, why do I want to do this thing like that? Because I want to work like in classical field theory where we have space-time as a differentiable manifold, and we can define their classical field theories without the need of a metric. Of course, if the theory, if the system requires a metric, and that goes into a Lagrangian, and then we have that input. But the primary ingredient is a differentiable manifold. Here, I want to have something like that, but for quantum field theories, in a sense. And I'm going to start talking about effective field theory at a given scale. And then for what do I mean by that is that if I do manage to talk about what's a scale, then I have a model that describes whatever physics happens at this scale. And if I have this for a collection of scales that somehow exhaust the whole space-time, I can measure it any scale, then I have a field theory in the continuum that I will call it like that. Scale, and then M is the refinement limit of the scales, okay? But then the question is, how do I construct one of these guys? An effective field theory at a given scale, and I want to construct it by a correction procedure as a limit of such thing, okay? So then I want to measure it at this scale, say of 5 meters, when I have a metric, then I just import corrections from theories that or models that can model things well at smaller scales, and then I get a corrected theory, like renormalization. So for this thing to make sense, I need inherently in this process something that is a theory space. I need to be able to say that I get an initial proposal, I call here prime field theory, for a given scale, I say this is my basic building block, and it's not given by God, it's just parameterized by a free parameter that are the coupling constants, okay? So I have not only one theory, but a one parameter or two parameter or several parameter family of theories that I have to be adjusted to describe physics in the real world, and then I coarse grain it and I get better prescription for a theory at other scales. We all have been talking about these things here. And so the goal of this slide is to point at some key concepts. One is scale, coarse graining, then effective field theories at given scales, observables, and this locality property that I call GBFT. Okay, and then I'm going to be talking about these concepts all along the talk. Scale, okay? So I want to now be more particular. I'm going to be talking about field theories from the Lagrangian point of view. So the Lagrangian has this domain, the position, the value of the field, and the derivatives. So these are first order Lagrangian theories then. And then my histories are local sections of this bundle, and I include also their derivatives. So I need to describe things at a given scale, say, using some set of partial observables that give me information about the where I am in as far as history is it, what history is the one I have, that talk about this space, right? The one that has positions, value the field and derivatives, okay? And then I have my operative definition of scale, that is, a measuring scale is a discrete collection of measuring devices. So in space-time, I have certain fields on top of it, and I arrange to be able to measure certain things in an array of detectors everywhere in space-time, and that's the measuring scale. And in a more algebraic way of talking, that is going to be part of the goal of the initial part of here, a scale then would be a structure of local subalgebras, that to every open set in the manifold, so I have a space-time, and I have a region of space-time, say in my lab, and to it I assign a subalgebra of observables. Which subalgebra? The one that I can generate with my few measuring devices that I have in my lab. Okay? There is a neighboring lab somewhere else, and they measure their own things. Okay? So I have a subalgebra of such observables generated by my measuring devices. Okay? And they are all inside some big algebra of the things I can measure in this space. Okay? There, I can measure, for example, the position, the value of the field, and the derivatives of the field. These are for the electromagnetic field. I can measure it, and I can measure derivatives in every single point in space-time. No? But so since I am in a finite scale, I cannot measure with arbitrary precision, only I can do some measurements. And this defines this subalgebra. OK, I do not just want a subalgebra like that. I ask things to this subalgebra. I ask that if I do evaluate these observables in any history that is a local section, and I do it for a collection of local sections, so I do exhaust space-time like this, sections over everywhere in space-time, then I determine several things. I determine this bundle that we had. So these sections, you may think of them as over local trivializations, and I have information about each local trivialization. So if I do have this information about the local trivialization in everywhere, then I should recover the bundle, but I have this partial information. What I'm saying here is the partial information is big enough that I do capture the structure of the bundle. And the second thing is that I do not know, say, the electric field everywhere, but I know it up to some details. These details are required to be just local deformations. So it's, I'll come back to that later. Okay. Okay, so that's it. This is talking about sections. And then this object here is talking about sections that agree up to the value and the derivatives. So there is a notion of agreement of the first order for given a notion of a scale, given a scale. What is the meaning of agreement of the first order or to second order? I will use that later explicitly. Then from this very general point of view, what is coarse graining then? Coarse graining means that I have this map. For every U, for every place in space-time, and I said I had assigned a subalgebra for scale delta, and then there is a subalgebra for scale delta prime. This is finer if it knows more details. So I can put every observable that I can see at a less resolution and see it in this space that has more information. Okay, so for me this is coarse graining. And it's compatible with what everyone has been saying here. Just the aim of doing this in an algebraic way is to be able to generalize it and and talk about other things. So for example, delta can be induced later, I will see, by a triangulation, by a cellular decomposition, or by an open cover of the manifold. And this way of thinking will allow us to bring many approaches together and even, for example, make contact with what happens in perturbative quantum field theory and other things. Okay, so what is, you saw some topological things in my definition, and the topological motivation was that we are used to working in GR with this discretization called Rayle calculus, and one of the original motivations of using it was that you could talk about a lot of the manifold by means of a discrete structure. So a manifold is a continuum structure, and the discrete structure is this triangulation that keeps a lot of the structure of the manifold, in particular all the topology. So in this same spirit, if we are now working on space-time but we have other fields, should we be able to keep all the topological information of the place where Lagrangian lives? No? The Lagrangian lives in these places where we have sections and derivatives of them, and there can be many different things. In particular, in gauge theories, there are non-equivalent bundles and other things. So should we have a field theory that is at a given scale and therefore carries discrete information, but know about this bundle structure at every scale, not just recover it in the continuum? That is impossible. If at all the scales you don't have it, then in the continuum you don't have it either. No? So here was the motivation. And then the definition accomplishes this thing. It says that if I am in a scale, and delta microscopical says means the things that I cannot see at that scale, the observables that I do not have in my subalgebra, then these things that I do not see about the, if I confuse two histories, they do not differ by a variation that tears. They are all deformable to each other. And so this sounds like mathematicians, blah, blah, blah. But then what can I do with that? If I have a variational problem that I want to attack at a given scale, does it make sense to say that it's related to my original variational problem that did live in a bundle? Okay, so I have a mathematical problem in the continuum that I know it has solutions in one bundle and it does not have solutions in another bundle, and I discretize it in a way that does not know about topology, then I end up with something that has no hope of capturing the knowledge of the continuum. Okay, so, and this other thing about coarse graining by summing over things when I'm in the, not in the classical, but in the continuum, in the quantum framework, I want to coarse grain by summing over things. And then when I do that, my sum is actually happening in a well-defined bundle. And I think that this gives the sums and these things a better backbone or interpretation or justification. So let me give some specific examples. So if I am in a scalar field theory, and then the fibers in my bundle are Rn or Rk, then what do? I coarse grain, say I define my algebra, my subalgebra, by decimation. So if I have a auxiliary triangulation that is going to help me define this, this subalgebra, then I assign points to the interior of each of the higher dimensional triangles, and then to the codimension one faces, I also assign one of these points to each of them, and I evaluate the value of the field. And I also keep their positions. This is if my field theory cares about the positions, then it should have this information. No? And so this was what happens in the continuum, and this is what information I have at my disposal at a given scale here given by a triangulation. I have this thing for every triangle. And so the thing about the subalgebras and stuff is that you just, I have a U here, I can just care about the observables that I have given the triangulation that is inside. If I have another U that is somewhere else, I have another subalgebra, and I can work locally like that. Okay, so I can do the same thing for sigma models. Okay, what are sigma models? They are like scalar fields, but they live in a more complicated bundle, potentially. Okay, so what the data do I have? The data that I have is, again, these positions, but then values of the field in different places. For example, I have this G nu and G tau n minus 1. The nu refers to this center of the bigger dimensional symplices, and the taus of dimension n minus 1 are these faces of codimension 1, and a face of codimension 2 in this case will be a point. And if I had a higher dimensional picture here, I could draw more points. So for the sigma model, I will need the values of the fields in the interior of the higher dimensional symplices, codimension 1 symplices, then codimension 2 symplices, and I will need more data. And the reason I need this more data is to be able to talk about how do I recover the bundle. The bundle is recovered by, after I have a bunch of sections in local trivializations, they do give me partial information about the transition functions. Okay? And this is just a formula for the transition functions in terms of compatible sections. Okay? And then having this information just gives me a transition function here, gives me a transition function here, transition function here. If I'm thinking about an open set that contains this thing and another open set that contains a neighboring triangle. So how do I glue them together? I have this partial information about the transition function. I really do not know it everywhere. Then there are many bundles that will be inequivalent sharing this data. And so there is a theorem that says that if I knew the transition function in this line completely, I will be able to give a bundle. Okay? And then there are many bundles that are different but equivalent in the sense that there is this bundle map or whatever. So when are they different but equivalent? Is when this knowledge of transition function here is deformable to another one. So I just have to keep track of these deformation classes. And this information, I put it here all together in something that I call W. I can specify more about it. Okay? But so this thing, what it does is discrete data again, that for example, if I have a U1 bundle and my base space is two-dimensional, tells me a grounding number. And if I have a SU2 bundle and the manifold is four-dimensional, then the boundary of my little disks here will be a sphere, a three-sphere. Then I could have non-trivial winding. So in these cases, there are non-trivial ways of gluing partial bundles. And then this data will be important, but it will be always of a discrete nature. Okay, so if I do have all this data, then I determine the bundle of two equivalents and my history, that is the history in the sigma models, that is assignment of group elements to different points. I will know it up to homotopy, and I will know exactly its value in some chosen points. Okay, the same thing I can do for gauge theory, and I'm not going to say it here with a lot of detail, but what I do is I take a construction of Barrett what he did, this was something after his PhD, just I guess contains part of his PhD thesis, and it's about recovering the bundle from just holonomies. Okay, so if you know the holonomy is about of a connection on every single loop, then you do know the connection and the bundle where it lives. So this is the space of loops that becomes a group, and this is the gauge group, and the holonomy, as we know, gives a group homomorphism. So if you know that this data, then you can reconstruct the bundle. But if I decimate it to work at a given scale, all the topological information is gone. Okay, and then what I'm saying here is that it's not completely gone. I just need to add a little bit of extra information that is all again encoded in this W. So I need to be able to have a family of loops or paths that are used for keeping track of connection data in a gauge invariant way, like we have been doing here. And this data quoted here is the same thing that we use for spin form models defined originally by Michael Reisenberger, some collection of edges that go from the center of a. So if I have something like this, and I have gauge theory data, then I put up an edge that goes from here to here, and an edge that goes from here to the codimension two things, and I can make circuits where I can evaluate plaquettes and things like this. Okay, so I finish with that prologue, with that big introduction about scale, and my notion of scale that is algebraic but keeps some track of some topological data. And now I'm going to change to something, second part of the talk, that is about some given collection of systems that are classical but do talk about these things that I'm talking about. So classical theories at a given scale, okay, in this thing. So I said that I wanted to work like in a Lagrangian formalism, so I need this jet bundle, but in a discrete version of that, okay? And then I'm going to define elements and things there, and that is going to be just a finite dimensional manifold, and everything is going to be defined there, but among the histories, I'm going to define a variational problem, and therefore I'm going to have solutions. And when I evaluate this thing that I define here on solutions, very nice things are going to happen. And I'm stressing that this thing here because there has been this tension that Bianca mentioned about what is quantum gravity and then solving quantum gravity. Here I do want to separate it. I'm going to define a theory, and solving it is going to be a different thing. So I can define a quantum theory. My goal is to define a quantum theory without the need to solve it. Okay, so here is explicitly broken that thing. If I'm going to talk about a phase space, it's not going to be the phase space in the space of solutions that I will have to probably construct in a way. I do want to be able to have a structure without needing to solve anything. Okay. This is the same thing I talked about before. Just some notation. These things are going to be called histories over U. And then I'm going to need variations of histories. And since this is my data, if you see here, I do not have the data talking about the position of the points, because I'm going to be talking about Lagrangians that do not use this thing. And I'm not going to, the variations are vertical. So in a sense, they will not vary the position. Then the variation, that is something you have to understand so you follow the next two slides, is just vectors in the tangent spaces of where the histories live. So a history is this collection of data, and the variations are these vectors there. Okay.
What do you mean by vectors along the fibers?
Along the fibers. And then what happens is that here in the horizontal level, I think I broke the microphone. And the clip, I broke the clip. Well, anyway, can you hear? For the next speaker, maybe a little proof. Anyway, so So vertical means that in the horizontal it's a simplicial complex, and then I decimate it to a bunch of points, and on top of each I have a fiber that is, for example, a group, something. So vertical is a variation in that direction.
But not necessarily just a gauge
variation. So any variation. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you got this is the. Okay, so here is the action, for example, and I'm given a section or a history, then the action is a sum over things. Each of these contributions may be thought about as integrate, as it's called a Lagrangian, but it could be also called an integration of the action in that little piece. Okay? And then I just calculate ds. And for calculating this thing, I do not need to know field theory as such. I just can do it in calculus on manifolds. So this lives in a manifold of very high dimension, but finite. Okay? And so what it has is partials of this object, the Lagrangian. Okay? And then I split them into different contributions, one that I assign to the boundary and one that is not related to the boundary. So again, I have here my picture. Here is U, and there is the boundary. And some of the triangles do touch the boundary, and they have several data, each of these simplices. For example, this simplex has this point here and a variable over it, a fiber over it. And it does not touch the boundary if the boundary passes by here. And if the if this triangle is one of them that touches the boundary, there is 1 degree of freedom that touches the boundary. No? So when I calculated ds, then these things are the ones that are the partials with respect to the degrees of freedom that live in the boundary. And these things are just writing what goes there. No? And then I asked for Hamilton's principle to determine what are the physical histories. And therefore, I neglect this term because I'm analyzing variations that vanish in the boundary. And this thing has to be zero. And so it gives me equations of motion or field equations. And they are of two kinds, some that are internal to the higher dimensional simplices and some that are gluing or momentum matching. So partials with respect to this equal to zero, they give me some equations of motion internal to this triangle. So I can say that in this simplex, I have solutions of the field theory on top of this simplex. And if I have a solution over this simplex and a solution of the neighboring simplex, to have a solution on the whole thing, they have to satisfy some other invariance on their variations of this degree of freedom. And this gives me gluing equations. OK, so I have equations of motions, blah, blah. And apart from equations of motions, I have something called geometric structure. And what is the geometric structure that I get? It comes from this thing called theta. And it has the same name as the symplectic potential because it is. It's a symplectic potential. So just in more dimensions, in a way. So just to recap this thing, the action gave me ds, and the ds, I broke it like this, and so it defined to me this theta. Okay. So it's not a canonical theta, but it comes from the partials of the Lagrangian. And if I define this thing, that is the theta, this thing is very similar to the symplectic form, but just is something called a multi-symplectic form. And the multi, it comes from saying that if I have any codimension one surface, sigma in particular could be the boundary of something, but it could be something else, then I can use it to integrate this thing, integrate it as is really a sum, and I generate a symplectic structure assigned to that thing. Okay? And how do I do it? I do it like this. Okay. This object then has three entries. The two first ones are vectors that are on these variations that I called them vertical before. And this other thing is not a vector. It's actually the label that I have here, tau now. The taus were the labels of the codimension one things. So I use nu to talk about the higher dimensional synthesis. And these ones, the codimension one, are called taus. So if I integrate over these things, I say, I sum over several of these things that. So a sigma has many taus, and I sum over the taus. This sum then is a sum over taus that belong to a sigma, and I put them all there in this. So this thing means that I put here pi, and I put here the taus that fit in sigma. I get a symplectic form. Well, actually, it's a presymplectic something because it may be degenerate. So it's a, antisymmetric two form that may be degenerate. If the Lagrangian is like that, it may not be degenerate, depends on the Lagrangian. Okay? And so, for example, for the scalar field, I can just write it down and I get a simple d phi d phi. This is a phi on the bulk part, this is a phi on the boundary. Okay, so somehow this is conjugated to that in a way. Okay, so what happens with this structure? It happens that there is a conservation law. So if I have any solution, right, that solves the equations of motion that they come from extremizing the action, then this thing holds. That the symplectic structure assigned to the boundary is kind of null. And how is it null? Null is because these vectors, and this thing is supposed to be a solution, and these vectors are not arbitrary variations, but they are called first variations. They are the ones that take solutions to solutions. So if I'm in solution space, that is a submanifold of the space of histories, and I move in a way that I still have a solution, then this thing satisfies this property. Okay, these two things. And the proof is a very simple thing. It's very similar to how you prove missing for in the continuum. Okay, so I talked already a little bit about the space of first variations. Okay, so if I consider a solution, the first variations are this tangent space, the variations of that thing. And I also talk about them sometimes as being related to some vector fields there. And it's going to be very important for me to characterize them for what follows. And what happens is that these ones satisfy a field equation, and these other ones, the things inside here, satisfy the linearized field equation. And it's just like that. The derivative of this operator, or this thing that defines the field equations, has to be zero. Okay. This is the thing that defines the field equations. Okay. And then this thing is a consequence. If you have a first variation, then as we saw, the first variation of a solution, it's a Lagrangian subspace of this, the space of first variations. Okay, so now it comes the meaty part of the third part of the talk, if you want. So I already talked about partial observables to define this discretization. In fact, it was created in terms of a choice of partial observables, but I'm interested in talking about observables at a given scale. Okay? So how would I do that without solving the field equation? I do not want to say I solve this thing and then I evaluate the function in the space of solutions, and that will be very difficult to actually do. So I will call F an observable current. If it's a current, that means that I'm going to be able to integrate it in codimension one surfaces. Okay? And it has to satisfy some things. Okay? But my requirements are only when evaluated on solutions. Otherwise, it's just a thing that I can integrate in codimension one. Okay? So when I evaluate it on solutions, I need this thing to happen and this thing to happen. Let me explain first the second one. Okay? So it means that if I integrate, say, in the boundary of anything, U prime, that is inside U, the domain of interest, then I get zero. And why do I want that thing to happen? I want it to happen for what follows here, because it will tell me that some observables I'm going to define. How am I going to define observables with an object like that? I'm going to integrate it. So these are the observables. The observables, then I define with a F and with a choice of sigma. Okay? So I integrate over sigma, and I get an observable that's a number that I associate to a given local section. Okay? So I want to see this label sigma as some kind of an auxiliary thing in the following sense. So if I have my manifold here, and I have this Cauchy surface, and I'm going to use it to define observables, I want it because it encodes initial data or data to that Cauchy surface. And what will happen if I choose a different Cauchy surface? What I want is that if I'm talking about solutions and not just data local to sigma or sigma prime, I want it to be the same. And so this thing I achieve by requiring that. Okay? The invariance, these two things differ as the boundary, the difference is the boundary of something. Where do I? Homologous means that the is the boundary of something. The difference, sigma prime minus sigma, is the boundary of U prime. Okay? So this is the nature of this condition. The other part means that by construction, I have to evaluate these things not only in codimension one, but in, since, see, here is my sigma, and I have a triangulation. So this is a part of my discretization. If I want to evaluate something here that knows about derivatives, I need to tell it how to take derivatives. So it has to compare the data here with something. So I tell it to compare it to here, then it takes derivatives, say, in the direction down. And if I tell it to compare it to here, it defines the derivatives or the momentum in the direction to the future. So I have to specify if it's with respect to nu or with respect to nu prime. OK, so here it says that the things should coincide when I'm talking about solutions. So this is very reasonable, because in solutions, a part of the equations of motion is the matching of momenta, that the momenta from here and the momenta from down are the same. So this actually means that it only depends on the physical momenta, the one defined by the Lagrangian. So these are the two conditions put on these Fs. And the ones that satisfy them, I call them observable currents. And the one simple observation is that they form a vector space. Okay, if I add or multiply by constant observable currents, I get another one like that. And here I phrased everything in terms of scalar fields, but it makes sense, and I have defined it also for sigma models and for gauge theory. So are these observables that I say I could construct with my definition observable currents good enough, or are they very poor? And then a very concrete question that I can use to have a definite answer is, if I can use observable currents to distinguish neighboring solutions. Okay, so what I do is I choose a curve of solutions starting, say, from a given solution. I have phi in the space of solutions. So here is the space of histories, and by here is some subspace, the space of solutions. I have a point, and then I choose a curve, gamma. This is phi zero. Okay? So the question is whether I can distinguish this solution from some other solutions that are in the curve. The curve is arbitrary for any such curve. Then what I have to do is to take this derivative. With respect to the parameter of the curve, I have to do the derivative of this thing. These are my observables. And then I do this thing. And this is the answer. I want it to be different from zero. Okay? And observable currents are very natural because they can participate in equations like this. Okay? And when they do, this is the thing that replaces the symplectic form, is this multisymplectic form. When they do participate in an equation like this, they are called Hamiltonian. And the vector that participates here in entering this two form with some other entry that is acting on chains, when I put this vector inside this two form, then it becomes a one form. And here is this DF, that is another one form. When there is a V that participates like this, called the Hamiltonian vector field, and this is a Hamiltonian observable current. Okay, so if I do have an equation like this holding, I replace it here, and the thing that I want it to be different from zero becomes this object. So if omega is somehow non-degenerate, given my W that has to do with the velocity of this curve, so I just gave you not a solution, but a one parameter family of solutions, and then it has a velocity at the initial point. This is the variation. So, and this I call W here. So W is given. And the question is if there is a V such that this thing is different from zero. And the answer it will be that in some sense, if omega is non-degenerate, then there should be a V. Okay. And then there are many versions of how can this be refined or something. Then our observable currents separating by measuring in the bulk. The thing is that what I just showed, and I needed this thing to be different from zero. If this thing is not degenerate, there must be a place in my U in region of space-time where this thing is different from zero. Then I choose the sigma also, so it passes by there. Okay, so then I will be guaranteed that this thing is different from zero. Okay, with the ability to move sigma everywhere in U. Okay, so here is the solution. I'm going to just leave it for you to read. There is nothing more than what I said. There is a stronger statement of wanting these observable currents to be able to separate things, separate solutions, and it's by measuring only in the boundary. Okay? Because these observables that I have are integrated in codimension one, and the very most natural thing, space to integrate over, if I have a region of interest, would be the boundary. So integrate, for example, if the boundary consists of a past boundary and a future boundary, by measuring only in the past boundary or in the future boundary. Okay, then again, there is a statement that yes, they do separate these things, but the requirement about non-degenerate is a little bit stronger. And anyway, how does it go that proof? The the proof goes like this. Just assume that this is my U, and I prove that my question about whether I can separate points or not, I have this phi zero, and they have a neighboring here, another solution nearby, and they can be separated by a given F that I chose that is related to some vector field V. And because I discover that the non-degeneracy something was true, that something was different from zero in a simplex tau here in the bulk of U, then I chose my sigma that contains this thing, and this is the original thing. But however, because of my definition, if I choose this other sigma contained completely in the boundary, sigma prime, since sigma minus sigma prime is the boundary of U prime, the boundary of U prime is equal to sigma minus sigma prime, I can detect or measure the same things here and here. So my original proof of non-degeneracy by measuring everywhere in the bulk can be transported to the boundary. So anyway, that's it. Then here I could talk more about them. If everything that I just said about this proof of my observable currents are enough to separate points in the space of solutions, depends on these Hamiltonian observable currents, then I have to know better what happens with the observable currents that are exactly of this type. And for that, it's natural to ask, if this signal is an observable current that means that satisfies my prescriptions, then what is inherited by V? And what happens is that this V turns out to be a very special vector field. It needs to be in the space of first variations, that is, it has to be tangent to the space of solutions. And vector fields. And it needs to satisfy more things. Okay, the more things have to do with this F satisfied a condition about integrated in the boundary of U prime, it had to get to be zero. Then the DF also satisfies something like this. And therefore, V has a condition. And the condition is that any V that defines like this some one form called sigma of B. And sigma of B needs to satisfy this property that integrated like this equal to zero. So at this level, it looks like very abstract. First, that this D of this thing has to be zero because this is just already a D. And because it needs to satisfy this thing. These conditions are acquire more of a geometrical character when you study them just a little bit. It turns out that this condition of D of sigma equal to zero means that this Li derives the symplectic, the multi-symplectic form. So this is the analogous of a Hamiltonian vector field, or a called locally Hamiltonian vector field that is weaker. And also, this condition has to do in an if and only if way with the V being tangent to the space of solutions. Okay, so that's it for this characterization of the V's. Okay, and the main condition is this one. Somehow, if this thing is satisfied, it happens that this condition is kind of trivial. But what I can see is that if it's satisfied in a part of the boundary, and this thing is satisfied in the bulk, then this thing is satisfied in the other part of the boundary. So this thing kind of propagates this other condition. I will not show that. So anyway, here I'm just examining this a little bit more. In classical mechanics, we are used to, if you are given a function, then you can associate to it a Hamiltonian vector field just with the Poisson brackets. No? Just calculate the Poisson brackets, and then you have this Hamiltonian vector field like that. And this happens only because the symplectic form is non-degenerate and the Poisson bracket is the inverse. Okay? So here, in general, it cannot be, it cannot happen. But in the discrete formulation that we have, so in the continuum is more non-trivial, in the discrete formulation, it may be that this is true. And in many cases, the omega is invertible. When it's invertible, everything works like in classical mechanics. Okay? If not, when this thing is not invertible, is the sign of having engaged freedom. Okay, so. So here I just state again that observable currents, if I wanted to use them to separate points in the space of solutions, it happens that a key ingredient was the relation between observable currents and vector fields. It turned out that these vector fields are not any vector fields, but they had to be a tangent to the space of solutions. So observable currents are in correspondence with the tangent space of the space of solutions. And the correspondence is roughly 1-to-1. And the observable currents can separate neighboring solutions. So then maybe I convince you that observable currents are the best thing in the world, and you're going to go learn everything about them to continue your research to find observables, okay? But you can do even more than that, than just finding observables. You can compute Poisson brackets among them. You can compute Poisson brackets by this simple formula, okay? And this thing then becomes a new observable current, and is again, if these two were Hamiltonian observable currents, this one is again a Hamiltonian observable current, and the Hamiltonian vector field is this. So that's this is now the moment to try to generalize and talk about more things, because you may tell me that you do not want to talk about observables that have to do only with codimension one things. You are maybe interested in bulk observables. So it seems that then my talk was not relevant because it was not talking about things that you can measure in space-time, but you needed to have some proto-Cauchy surface. But I will tell you now that this, if you see this structure for the Poisson bracket, and you remember that omega is d theta, and theta in the space of solutions is ds, this thing is actually talking about how the action changed to some other action. See, I can think of this philosophy behind this Poisson bracket as changing the action to some action that depends on a parameter lambda. And I have this one parameter family of actions that I do by shifting the action a little bit using f. Okay. If I do that, in fact, here is wrong. I should put a sigma, not the whole boundary of u. I have to put here part of the boundary of u. So this is a typo. I need a sigma there. And then this thing will shift the critical points. If I have a solution and I move it a little bit in this direction, it will not be a solution anymore, but it will be neighboring solutions of that, of the new action. Okay? So it gives a one parameter family of solutions. And that thing will derive, you can derive g in the direction of the variation that f induced. Okay? And this gives you exactly these Poisson brackets. And this is the philosophy that leads to the Parallels bracket. And I can use it not for boundary observables, but also in the continuum. In the bulk. I can use it in the bulk. And then what will happen in the bulk? I will have here something that is an integral in the bulk, and not, and it will induce to me a vector field. And from vector fields, I can induce my observable currents. So what happens is that Parallels bracket, in fact, is not a bracket among observables in the bulk, but it divides them into equivalence classes. And they are identified if they agree on solutions. And not only they agree on solutions, but how they change. So first is they agree on solutions. And the second part of the equivalence is if they agree on how they affect the action, they are again considered equivalent. So here what happens is that this Poisson bracket makes equivalence classes of things in the solution in the among the functions on the bulk. And these functions on the codimension one things, they label the classes. So for every class, there is one of these solutions in the, observables in the boundary. So they are giving you very nice information. Anyway, I'm not going to say more than that. Then I'm about to finish this summary. So I first gave a brief introduction and highlighting the importance of scale, coarse graining, and field theory at a given scale, but not only for gravity, but for field theories in general. And I wanted to address this thing in manifolds that not necessarily had a background metric. Okay? And also, we needed to talk about observables. My strategy to talk about observables was not only partial observables, but real observables of the kind that they can be measured in codimension one, and I call them observable currents. And I studied them, and it was in a GBFT spirit, because everything that I defined was in, regarding these atoms, that they had their boundaries, and they communicated through the boundaries. Okay. And anyway, it was classical. Then you may tell me about this. We wanted to talk in this conference mainly about quantum stuff. So what is the relation with what you are doing with quantum? And if I do path integral, then in particular, if I am in the gauge theory version of my classical thing, the path integral takes directly to spin form models. In fact, it was the classical thing was defined after the quantum, just to try to study its classical prequel, no? To say something that if I quantize it, I get to spin form models. And again, it follows these GBFT things. There are a few things that do not just import to the quantum thing. And one of the things is, the thing is that many times this omega does have a kernel. So if I want to use my omega to define structures in the quantum theory, for example, a measure, L2 measure or something, if I don't just do position space or Schrödinger representation, if I want to do phase space things, I naturally get measures that have a kernel. They are measures with a kernel. I get in the phase space, I get something that is not a good measure. But the degenerate directions have physical meaning. They have to do with the gauge. So if I take a quotient, I will arrive to something that is well defined and perfectly nice. The same thing will happen with inner products. I could define a Hilbert space with an inner product, but if I just do it naively at the beginning, I get something with a kernel, non-positive definite inner product. Another thing that I have to say, if I'm going to quantize this thing kind of directly, is that this very nice property that Q defined with a sigma or with a sigma prime, that is a deformation of the first one, they were the same. It happened in the space of solutions, when evaluating the space of solutions. If I do path integral things, this thing will not happen, because I will sum over things that are not solutions. And then I get another factor here that has to do with information in the bulk. So if these sigma and sigma prime are deformation of each other, and they differ by the boundary of U prime, then this term has to do with integrating something in U prime. Well, I know what it is, at least a formal expression of that. And it's kind of natural that that is there. So that's it.
Great.
So, any questions? So, now you talked about introduction of discretization in terms of some simplicial splitting up of the manifold. Why did you choose simplices?
Why did I choose simplices? I could choose any other thing that are not simplices, as, for example, cellular decompositions or something. But, and I, as I said in the beginning, it should be an advertisement to take the beginning more, the abstract beginning more seriously. I can also, maybe not for what we are doing in gauge theory, because coarse graining or averaging in gauge theory seems to be quite difficult if you don't use the parallel transport. But if you are in a scalar field, then you may want to integrate over something with a measure that you already have. So I'm doing decimation, but if I have an open cover that covers a manifold, and I know how to take averages in some natural way for the theory, I could do something different than decimation, and I could integrate over things. Then I do not need simplices. I can just have an open cover. So other reason for using simplices is just to make contact with the spin forms. I don't have any other.
And now you talked about this discretization in terms of the scale. So what's the intuition of what would happen if you change that scale? Would you say, well, these configuration spaces or these bundles would embed into each other, basically using the decimation?
Yeah.
Or
yes.
Is there something more complicated?
So basically, if I had given a version of this talk some many, many years ago, I would have thought that I could just include more points in my fine scale, and I would not need any more thing, information. So let's say, for example, I have this bit of space-time, and I decimate, and I have this piece of information for this whole region. So someone else comes and gives me some more information in what it has more points. And then how do I coarse grain? I just forget all the other information except for this one. This is the decimation thing. And this thing, if I'm talking about a sigma model that happens on a bundle, it's not good enough information, not even at a given scale. I need more information to glue things. So first, if I am in the spirit of spin forms a la Michael Reisenberger, I have more data, some data on the boundaries. Okay, and then this is still not enough information, because I want to glue local trivializations, because I want to recover the bundle. And then I need to have some extra data that lives in how these things are glued. And this data is naturally glueable. Like if I glue a bundle with another bundle, it gives me another bundle. So the extra data that is some homotopy classes of something, it can be glued. I'm not saying that it is simple, but just when it's sometimes it's trivial and then you don't have to do anything. When it's not trivial, it's always some winding number of something. And so you know it's an integral, an integer that you can calculate in terms of the other integer. I have not studied well simple models except for abelian ones. In the abelian ones, I just have to add numbers. And so that coarse-graining is very simple just by addition. In the other non-abelian ways, it should be again abelian, but I really have not finished that, how to coarse-grain that part of the data. But I know it's there, so I do not know what's the formula, but it's there.
Okay, any more questions? Not then, let's thank you again.